Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A political earthquake has shaken South America's poorest nation to the bone in the last month. The uprising in Bolivia was sparked by a deal to sell liquefied natural gas. By the time it was over, the president had been ousted, and a long, deep list of grievances was on the table. They are still there, and they reach all the way to Washington tonight on Point, Peasant Uprising in the Heart of Latin America. But first to California, where firefighters are getting a little relief from Mother Nature. Today, cooler weather and some rain brought mixed blessings for firefighters trying to contain the huge wildfires. Strong winds threatened to breathe new life into two of the most destructive blazes. The wildfires have now been blamed for 20 deaths, including one firefighter. Los Angeles Times reporter Tony Perry has been our eyes and ears on the frontline fire. He joins us now from San Diego. Hello, Tony. What do you see today?
What I see today is rain and cooler weather, and the winds, while they were whipping to and fro, seem to have subsided. San Diego is breathing a sigh of relief that the worst is over and the end is in sight, and not a moment too soon. 1,600 homes, 350,000 acres, and the tally just goes up and up. And deaths, we expect that also to rise. As one backcountry rancher told me, I've been through two nights of hell on earth, and his is a common experience. Nothing like this in the history of this county has ever occurred before.
It has been an amazing thing to observe. Tony, if you could look down on Southern California tonight, where is the fire? Is it one big fire now? How many fires? How would they look from the air?
They would look like separate fires from the air. The smoke might mingle, but luckily the fires have not merged. There are probably four large fires, two of them in this county. They did not merge. The firefighters fought in San Diego County a valiant effort to keep the Cedar Fire and the Paradise Fire from merging, and then the Paradise Fire and the Cedar Fire and the Mine Fire from merging. What they tried to do was divide and conquer. They have divided and kept them divided. Mm-hmm. And now the question is, when will they conquer these fires? They fought a valiant effort successfully to save a little mining tourism town called Julian, 4,200 feet up in the Cuyamaca Mountains. They won that battle, but 300-plus homes were destroyed in a nearby mountainous community called Cuyamaca. One of the firefighters out there said that a 300-foot tall wall of flame 15 miles wide swept through Cuyamaca, destroying everything within its grasp. Luckily, the alarm had been sounded and the evacuation was fairly orderly and everybody got out, thank goodness. That was not the case Sunday when this fire first erupted and people died in their cars, died in their homes without any warning or with only moments warning. It was brutal, truly brutal.
And if the tide has now turned, Tony, as you say, is that being attributed primarily to the change in weather? How much of it's due to the efforts of all those firefighters out there? What's the balance?
Well, enormous efforts, little of all things, any port in a storm, yes. Valiant efforts by 3,000 firefighters from throughout the western United States. Finally, at long last, starting yesterday morning, air tankers and air water-dropping helicopters finally were brought to bear. There was bureaucratic slowness. There were squabbles among officials. There were also demands on those what they call air assets in other fires in Southern California, and they simply couldn't get down to San Diego County to fight the fires. And in an agonizing bureaucratic snafu, four Navy helicopters with trained personnel who drop water on fires on massive federal and military property all the time were ready to go, sitting on the tarmac Sunday morning when dropping some water could have possibly arrested this fire, kept it from getting nearly as large. But because they didn't have the proper certification to please state officials, they were kept grounded for 48 hours while much of this county burned. That's an agony. Politicians are furious. Homeowners are even more furious. And to put it bluntly, there's going to be hell to pay over how this fire was fought and not fought in the first 48 hours.
Sure to be a few upset insurance companies as well. How many more days or hours then, if things continue to go well, then, Tony Perry, until the last flame is stamped out? Any sense?
They're talking middle of next week for the largest, the most disastrous of the fires, the Cedar Fire, the one that destroyed some 1,400 homes itself and 350 homes in a fancy neighborhood in San Diego, for example. They're talking the middle of next week, fingers crossed, if all goes well and the weather and the wind cooperate.
Well, good luck to you and to everybody fighting there. Tony Perry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Tony Perry is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from San Diego. Earlier this month, a seemingly simple deal to sell liquefied natural gas sparked a political explosion that rocked South America's poorest country, Bolivia. The gas was a flashpoint for much bigger issues. Bolivia's indigenous peasant majority is shouting that it is too poor, that it does not like globalization, and that it does not want to stop growing coca, the source of cocaine, just because Washington says to. It's given a new president 90 days to make radical changes. This hour on Point, uprising in Bolivia. Did you think that peasant revolutions were a thing of the past? And what is the message in the smoke over La Paz? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Bogota, Colombia, is John Otis, Latin America bureau chief for the Houston Chronicle. He covered the dramatic events that led to the downfall of President Sanchez de Lozada. Good evening and welcome, John Otis.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Thanks very much for joining us. John, set the stage. We're going to be talking about everything that went into this incredible uprising in the last couple of weeks ago in Bolivia. But set the stage for us. We hear about a natural gas pipeline. That doesn't sound like enough to lead to the overthrow of a president. What were the forces at work?
It might not sound like much, but there's much behind it. For one thing, Bolivia is just about the poorest country in all of Latin America. Most people there live on about $2 a day. Bolivia was also kind of a guinea pig for globalization in South America. It was one of the first countries to privatize its industries and get rid of subsidies and that sort of thing. The natural gas project was seen by a lot of poor Bolivians as just another element in the whole free market scheme of things that many believe hadn't done much for them. Also, the pipeline was running through its neighbor, Chile, which is a longtime rival of Bolivia, because the two nations fought a war 100 or so years ago, and in that war, Chile annexed Bolivia's coast, so it left Bolivia landlocked. So they didn't like to see their natural resources running through Chile and then heading up to the United States, which is where the end point of the liquefied natural gas is basically supposed to go to the southwest United States.
Right, so they didn't feel confident that they would benefit from exporting the country's big natural resource there. And in the event, a lot of other issues were uncovered as well.
Well, that's correct. I mean, for one thing, most Bolivians don't even have natural gas in their own homes. If you're out in the countryside, they cook with wood. Or if they're in the cities, a lot of them use propane little canisters that they buy on the street. That's a lot more expensive. So the president was going to start exporting natural gas before most Bolivians even had it installed in their own homes. Another thing that sort of came into it all is that the president was very weak to begin with. It wasn't so hard to topple President Sanchez de Lozada because he'd only won election with 22% of the vote last year, so he didn't have a whole lot of popular support to begin with, and that sort of was one of the first things to set things off. It allowed the allowed things to get out of control.
John, describe those few days that led to the resignation of President Sanchez de Lozada. What exactly happened?
Well, I got there a couple of days ahead of time, and the protests were so successful that they'd completely cut off La Paz, the capital, from the rest of the nation. I came into the international airport, which is about 10 miles from La Paz, And I had to start walking into the Capitol. And in the end, I had to pay a teenager a couple of dollars to give me a lift on the back of his bicycle to give me a ride down the mountainside into La Paz, because things were so cut off. There were the derailed trains or boxcars blocking the roads.
And the they in this case is masses of poor Bolivians who came out of the slums that surround downtown La Paz, the mountains that surround.
Exactly. And it wasn't just from La Paz. They were marching into La Paz from all over the place. I remember hundreds and hundreds of miners in their hard hats chewing coca leaves and carrying sticks of dynamite walking right past our hotel and wandering around the streets. You could hear dynamite charges going off throughout the days leading up to the president's resignation.
The government's first response was quite violent. Something like 70 protesters died in the streets. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I visited a hospital ward, and it was just full of dozens of Bolivians who had gunshot wounds. People with shots in the stomach, in the arms, all laid up in the hospital. And you know, it's kind of hard for Americans to imagine something like that. But it's like, you know, having 70 people killed at one of these big WTO protests in Seattle. It's a lot of bloodshed, and that really turned the tide against the president, because one thing is to start privatizing things and people being poor and not seeing any results, but when the ill-trained police and army turn their guns on poor Bolivian peasants, that really set things off.
So describe then that last series of events that led to his resignation and the incoming of a successor.
In the end, the president, who, as I said earlier, didn't have very much popular backing to begin with, most of his political allies just gave up on him. And so Sanchez de Lozada, the president, ended up resigning on a Friday night, escaping out of La Paz on a helicopter and taking a flight up to Miami. His vice president, a well-respected journalist who was his anti-corruption czar, was sworn in the next day, and he's now the president, and he's going to face a lot of the same problems as the man he replaced.
Where is Sanchez de Lozada now?
I believe he's in Miami and just sort of cooling his heels and probably trying to figure out what went wrong.
And the peasant leaders, at least some of them, have said his successor, President Mesa, has 90 days to do what?
Well, they're giving him 90 days to reconsider the natural gas project. The president has said he'd put it up for a popular vote. In some areas of the country, there's actually a lot of support for this project because it would bring a lot of royalties to those parts of the country. But in other areas, people are dead set against it. They're also very much against the U.S.-backed efforts to wipe out the coca leaves, which produce cocaine. Now, that's the one crop that many poor Bolivian peasants have managed to make a pretty good living off of, because the price of cocaine is so high, and they want the U.S. drug war in Bolivia to end.
But the U.S. has not been willing to cut Bolivia any slack on that. I think the former president was asking for some relief on that insistence. The U.S. government said no. What else can the U.S. government say? They've got a big drug problem at home.
That's correct. So the new president is really in a bind. Most presidents in the South American countries, they're very loath to go against any kind of U.S. drug policy, even though all these efforts to wipe out coke over the last 20 years haven't really worked. They're making a big effort here in Colombia to do it, and it's had some success, but it pushes it back down into Peru or back down into Bolivia. It's sort of what they call a balloon effect. You plant down in Bolivia, it moves up to Colombia, and it just moves around like a big shell game.
And, John, let me ask you, finally, there seems to be a racial element here of some kind, but I don't want to impose an American view, a U.S. view on that. What is that component here?
Well, about half of all Bolivians are Quechua or Aymara Indians. Yet the people who have ruled Bolivia for much of its history have been descent, you know, basically white people. And so there is a very much a racial element in all of this. The president who was deposed, for instance, spent his early years in the United States, and many people called him the gringo because he spent so much time in the United States and actually spoke Spanish with kind of an American accent. So that really was present down there. Everybody called him, they didn't call him the president, they called him the gringo.
A real boiling cauldron. John, we're out of time before the break, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, good to be here, Tom.
John Otis, Latin American Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle. We're talking tonight about insurrection in Bolivia, a peasant uprising in the heart of Latin America. You can join the conversation. Did you think that peasant revolutions were a thing of the past? And can you understand why Bolivian peasants would rather sit on their natural gas than sell it right now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about insurrection in Bolivia, a peasant uprising in the heart of Latin America. You can join the conversation. What do you see as the message being sent from La Paz, the message being sent here to the purveyors of globalization, to the czars of the drug war? And is there a threat of a domino effect rejection of the global economy in Latin America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Miami by Eduardo Gamarra. He's director of the Latin American and Caribbean Center at the Florida International University, author of Revolution and Reaction, Bolivia 1964 to 1985. Good evening and welcome, Eduardo Gamarra.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Washington, George Ann Potter, senior fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, advisor to the Six Women's Peasant Federations and National Women's Peasant Movement of the Bartolina Sisa, longtime resident of Bolivia. Good evening and welcome, George Ann Potter.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Eduardo, in Miami, to you first, if you would, we've heard a little bit about the people who have been engaged in this conflict in Bolivia, but what are the forces in conflict here that have led to the ouster of a president, a new president, and so much uncertainty about what lies ahead?
Well, I think the rather simplistic way of looking at what happened in Bolivia is to put it solely within the confines of the so-called war on gas. Bolivia is a very complex country with at least five or six profound structural issues that have affected the development of the country over the last almost 200 years. And one of the most profound factors, of course, is a deep pattern of social exclusion, a pattern of social exclusion that I think has been addressed in many ways in a very incomplete way over the last 50 years.
Are you talking along racial or ethnic lines here, this exclusion? Economic?
Yes, but I'm also talking about economic. And, you know, one of the things that people tend to forget is that Bolivia was one of the first countries after Mexico to undergo a profound social revolution, paradoxically led by the very MNR, the Nationalist Revolutionary Movement Party, which is the party of former President Sánchez de Lozada. And so in that sense, you know, one of the great paradoxes of Bolivia is that it is a country where the political class, in its own rather imperfect way, has tried to deal with these profound problems that the country has faced, and has done so in a way in which many of the problems that the country faces have actually been exacerbated by the very policies that they pursued.
So, George Ann Potter, what's your view? Is the country better off with President Sánchez de Lozada sitting in Miami and a new president in his place? Has this been two or three weeks of progress here, or steps toward chaos?
Certainly not chaos. He apparently himself is quite relieved. I was at a meeting at the Johns Hopkins University today, and he was last week speaking here in Washington at the Inter-American Dialogue, and apparently was very relieved to no longer be DPP president of Bolivia.
So he may be relieved. I mean, there's a lot of problems, but is it good for Bolivia? What is really going on in Bolivia in your kind of shorthand for us, Georgia?
A week ago Friday, was in front of the U.S. Embassy here in Washington to do a demonstration against the violence that was being perpetrated, and it turned into a celebration.
At the Bolivian Embassy there.
Right. But the celebration, I pointed out, let's be very cautious about what we're celebrating. Certainly the end of violence was to be celebrated. But now we've got to make the country work. I believe that John mentioned a 90-day limit that's been proposed by one of the peasant leaders. But the more important peasant leader, who is Evo Morales, has actually given a larger margin to the new president, Carlos Mesa. And actually, there are a list of demands that I am prepared to present to you, and which the new president, who's the constitutional president, because he was the vice president, has agreed to. So
you've got the list of things that the peasant groups want done. Lay them out for us. What are the most significant ones? What's on the list?
Well, the first was that Goni go, and so he's gone. Goni was the nickname for Sanchez de Lozada. Just today I talked to the peasant movements because I don't feel that I'm empowered to talk unless I talk to them every day.
Great.
And apparently today in Sucre, which is the legal capital of Bolivia and where the Supreme Court exists, a judicial action was taken for his return to Bolivia to stand trial for the murder and assassination of people not only during the last month but during his year and 3 month.
So they want him out of Miami, the former president, and back in the country for trial.
Right, and that today was formally presented to the Supreme Court.
And you said President Mesa has agreed to this?
No, I said that the first request was that Goni leave the country,
and he did. All right.
And now just today this. But what President Mesa has agreed to, and was his the number two request or demand, is for a constitutional assembly to review the entire constitution of Bolivia, and President Mesa has agreed to that. The third request was for a referendum on the sale of the gas, the natural gas, and President Mesa has also agreed to that. The other issues then become a little more tenuous, and to my knowledge, President Mesa has not yet agreed to them. But I think the word globalization has been used in this broadcast so far, and certainly the peasant movement in Bolivia, and not only the peasant movement, the popular movements in Bolivia, are against the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, FTA in English, ALCA in Spanish. They also are asking for a review of the land tenure, the INRA law. And surprisingly, the last of the list is the coca issue. And since I do work with the cocaleros, that's something I'd be willing to talk about. But it's the last of the sort of demands. And by the way, hello, Eduardo, and hello, John.
We'll talk about the coca crop because, of course, that's what Washington doesn't want coming up. But, Eduardo Gamarra, what about this list? It sounds extraordinarily sweeping all the way to jiggering the Constitution. I mean, this really does sound like a kind of revolution. Is it underway? Is it going to work?
Well, you know, this is a very interesting list, and in many ways, of course, it's also rather interesting because President Mesa is a constitutional president whose mandate constitutionally ends in the year 2007.
Mm-hmm.
The demands that these associations have requested, in fact, are. With the exception of, for example, the discussion on the FTAA,
free trade area of the Americas,
the free trade area of the Americas. Mm-hmm. For example, the gas referendum and the Constituent Assembly are both unconstitutional. There is no clause in the current constitution that would basically establish the mechanism for a referendum to go in place. The same thing with a constituent assembly. There is no clause in the current constitution for a constituent assembly. And thirdly, the third thing that the current president had proposed and is now backing away from is the transitional nature of his government, which is also an unconstitutional thing because his term is until the year 2000, he either stays until the year 2000 or if he resigns
2007, you said
2007, mm-hmm. And if he resigns, the presidency constitutionally is to go to the president of the Senate and then the president of the House and then the president of the Supreme Court. But in any event, what Bolivia is moving toward, it appears to me, is a real need for a broad national pact that would be, that would incorporate the need for these kinds of reforms. But I don't see these occurring within the next 90 days. And in fact, I think if these demands continue and these demands aren't met in the next 90 or 180 or, for that matter, in the next 360 days, what we have in essence moved into, not only in Bolivia but throughout Latin America, is this idea that when governments do not perform, civil society can emerge and basically violate the constitutional lining of a society because, you know, its demands haven't been met. And so I think, you know, what you have here is I think, in a sense, it's either a great revolution or what we're justifying are, you know, these civil society uprisings that have already toppled, for example, presidents in Argentina, in Ecuador, now in Bolivia, and probably in Venezuela as well.
Eduardo Gomara, if I can read between the lines here, you seem to be portraying that as a big problem. Georgianne Potter, I'm not sure that I'm hearing you describe it the same way.
And Eduardo, mucho cariño, but the truth is, we're old friends, the truth is that the major political force in Bolivia, other than the current president, who is constitutional, and we're very happy it was a constitutional change, is Evo Morales, and he is not calling for the 90-day. If I didn't make that clear, it's one of the other opposition people. I can't even call him a leader, but Felipe Quispe, who had put the 90-day stricture on. And, you know, we're counting the days, and then Advent comes in, and Christmas, and New Year's, and All Kings Day.
Right, but
what I'm saying is, I do not believe that the 90-day stricture is what the majority of.
I don't know, Georgia, and I have La Razón, La Paz's main newspaper here, dated earlier in the week, and there's a declaration by Evo Morales basically arguing that, you know, if Mesa does not comply with these demands, that they will lead demonstrations to topple him. And yesterday, in fact, this other person whom you don't want to call a leader, Felipe Quispe, has said that not only would they would overthrow him, using basically language that we were accustomed to listening from military rulers, and, you know, which is an interesting thing, this notion of a civil society coup.
It sounds to me like we're way beyond constitutionality here, and certainly reading the reports out of Bolivia today, quoting peasants who are out in the countryside taking over big Bolivian ranches, or at least trying to.
That's a different movement. Well, that's the movement seemed to a movement that really started in Brazil called the Movimiento Sin Tierra.
Well, fair enough, but we saw streets full of people. For a while, not entirely differentiated. And all I'm saying is you've got ordinary Bolivians here who are paying attention to what sounds like a 90-day clock that they care about, that there is really a fuse on this thing. I want to begin to open our conversation up to our callers because a lot want to join this conversation. Marcos is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Marcos. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I wanted to start before I go to the point that I talked with your screener. It's funny that you say about people toppling governments. I think that not long ago something happened in California, right?
Yes, anyway, there was an election in California.
But it's done through a mechanism in the Constitution. When you don't have mechanisms that allow people to express themselves and get redress, they will look for the thing. And that's where the context comes from that I want to talk. It is not people that suddenly do not like to have a gas pipeline through Chile only, even though that's obviously a problem. But if you look at the history of Bolivia since the conquistadores were there, Bolivia has been robbed of all its minerals with very little, if not actually slavery, to show for the people that were there.
So are you encouraged by the events of the last month in Bolivia, Marcos, or not?
Yes, I am, actually.
And why? Where do you think this is headed?
This is headed like it's heading, I think, all over the world. People are starting to realize that we cannot live in a, you know, in a globalization where, you know, we have 200 companies that decide what we can do and we cannot do. That's why it's so important that they are against the the new treaty, the new Latin American treaty.
The free trade area.
Yep, the free trade. That's my take. That means I'm from Argentina personally, but in any case.
But you see a poor country, at least part of it, standing up and saying, we're not going to play the globalization game. I want to put that to our guests, but thank you so much for your call, Marcos. Eduardo Gamora, what about it? Is that part of the message here, that Bolivians don't want to be part of a globalized economy? And is that a real option?
Well, I'd like to address the first part of the question that, you know, there was no constitutional mechanism. There is no constitutional mechanism to basically have a recall of presidents who are bad.
So you didn't have the Schwarzenegger option.
No, we did not. And what's fascinating about this, in fact, that right before President Sanchez de Lozada was elected, I worked with the current president on a proposal along those lines to try to push for a midterm recall of sorts.
You weren't quick enough, Eduardo.
No, we weren't quick enough, and of course we sort of knew that at some point that this kind of situation was going to happen.
But take us to this globalization issue, because it seems core here somehow.
Well, look, I obviously have a very different perspective than those who think that that somehow we can revert back to this era in which countries could develop on their own without any kind of linkage to the rest of the world. I happen to think that what's happened in Bolivia right now, as good as it may be in terms of social movement empowerment, I think it's also a tragedy in terms of what Bolivia can expect now. I frankly don't think that the situation for Bolivia is going to improve. The economic situation is certainly going to get worse. There is no international company that is going to invest in Bolivia. And more importantly, what you already have in Bolivia is a tremendous deluge of private Bolivians who are basically moving, and they're moving their capital out of the country with them as well. So the moments that Bolivia is about to see are much worse, and I don't see how the situation of Bolivians as a whole will improve as a result of this. Never mind that they are more politically empowered, but the fact of the matter is that no country at this stage in history is able to live without any kind of pattern of integration into the world economy.
Georgianne Potter, do you agree?
Oh, gosh, I guess I agree if one looks at recent history. I've written two books on globalization and the debt crisis and the trade issue. I'm hopeful that there could be regional alliances. They wouldn't have to be necessarily something as broad and dominant as the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. We saw what happened in Cancun with the World Trade Organization. I agree with Eduardo that we cannot go back to the 60s where one is into total economic independence, but certainly there are other economic models, and I don't think Bolivia is the first country to show that the globalization model is beginning to show its phrays.
But is there a viable path out of it is the question. I mean,
yeah.
Is it a real option? Well, Eduardo Gamarra says no. Many economists say no.
I know. But neither Eduardo nor I are economists.
That doesn't buy you a pass tonight. We've got to take a short break.
I actually do think there is a chance. I think there's a chance through, as I said, regional. Mercosur is another option.
We'll come back and look at that. Georgianne Potter, Eduardo Gamarra, please stand by. We'll also look at where coca lives in the middle of all this. We're talking tonight about insurrection in Bolivia. A president is out. A new one is in place. In some ways, all bets are off in the heart of Latin America. Are Bolivia's peasants dreaming that they can win by opting out of globalization? Are they on to something? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about insurrection in Bolivia, a peasant uprising in the heart of Latin America, maybe a kind of voting with the feet against globalization. My guests tonight are Eduardo Gamarra. He's director of the Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University, joining us tonight from Miami. From Washington, Georgianne Potter, senior fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. You can join the conversation as well. Is the United States paying enough attention to what's going on in Latin America when Bolivian farmers insist on growing coca, the base plant of cocaine? What should Washington's answer be? And who's got your heart, who's got your mind in this uprising? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mary's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
What I want to say is that I do think that the uprising in Bolivia is part of a general awakening to the bad news that the FTAA represents.
Free trade area, that is a kind of code for globalization, open trade.
Right, exactly. We have already in place something called NAFTA. We're working on something called CAFTA, Central American Free Trade. I don't know what the A is in
okay.
that, but the FTAA is going to have a big meeting in Florida in November, and many, many organizations internationally are planning to be there. I think what's happening is that around the world, people are waking up to the dangers that this kind of thing brings for completely undoing local economies, for making international trade superior to the viability of a country's own, for instance, ability to feed their own people.
But Mary, you know, economist after economist that we've had on this show has said to us, yes, it's not easy, it's hard, but this is necessary. This is the way to ultimately have real growth over the long term. It's a train every country has to get on. Do you not buy that?
I do not buy that because I know of other plans that are being put forward, and I've been sitting here pounding on my head trying to remember the name of, and maybe...
Well, the names won't help us, but what's the dynamic?
There is another plan
mm-hmm.
for organizing global trade that would allow people to protect the natural resources, allow people to protect workers' rights, allow people to basically retain a good deal of autonomy. We're supposed to be a democracy here, and yet what's happening with this corporate growth is a total undoing of democracy, taking away people's ability to make decisions that affect their own lives. And as people get more and more aware of how profound this is, there's going to be more and more rebellion against things like the FTAA.
Mary, we've got it, and we feel your passion around it. Thank you for your call. And certainly there was a lot of voting with feet in La Paz just 2 weeks ago. George Ann Potter, can you put some real specific, concrete meat on these bones?
And in Cancun before that.
And in Cancun, but they didn't change a head of state there. Give us some very concrete examples of what free trade or globalization, if you will, might have brought to Bolivia that Bolivian peasants would recognize and reject. Give us some real examples.
I will, but I also want to challenge the phrase or the term of insurrection in Bolivia. Despite what Eduardo said, I think there was a constitutional democratic change of governments and not an insurrection.
Well, that may be my word, but we saw streets loaded with people, a lot of bloodshed, and at the end of it, a change of government. I mean, it happened to fall into a constitutional pattern, but it wasn't all clear in the doing.
Let me get to the free trade issue. Well, I think the gas was the spark. It was the chispa. It was the spark, but it was not the main. And I think that both John and Eduardo have alluded to that, there are other issues.
Because people are talking about more intimate aspects of the economy.
Well,
make those real.
I mean, I live in Cochabamba. I don't live in La Paz.
Where's that?
And Cochabamba is the third largest city in the country. And we fought for our water rights in the year 2000, where Bechtel Corporation was going to take over our water. We went to the streets and we won back our water rights.
And the point there, they were supposed to build a good water system. In return, you were going to have to pay Bechtel for the water.
300% more, and they invested nothing. But free trade, the other big issue that the peasants, because I work more with the peasant sector, there's the other sectors in Bolivia, obviously, but I can speak mm-hmm. with some authority for the peasants. They're very concerned about genetically altered introduction of products and seeds. And your previous speaker, Mary, I think, from Arlington, mm-hmm. Massachusetts, spoke somewhat passionately about how free trade is not going to help poorer countries. And I think there are alternatives to rampant free trade. Free trade is not fair trade. There's terminology about fair trade. And I don't think Eduardo's right that there's no alternative to the global. Even Jeffrey Sachs, who, you know, is quite well known, having been at Harvard and now at Columbia, mm-hmm. and an advisor to the recently ex-president of Bolivia, and who writes in the New York Times and the Washington Post all the time.
We know him well.
You know, excuse me?
We know him well, a frequent guest.
I do, too. I've sat at his desk.
So?
and his mea culpas are somewhat resonating these days. And, you know, Jeffrey says we done wrong. We did it bad in 1985 when we imposed a draconian structural adjustment program in Bolivia. And he's, you know, now trying to make up for lost time. So I think there are alternatives. Economists and political scientists and anthropologists. I'm an anthropologist. And, I mean, there are alternatives. It's the new world order, but new. Not the Bush new world order, not the old Bush new world order. This is a new time. And, we've got Lula in Brazil.
In Brazil.
We've got Chavez in Venezuela. Let's see what might be able to be done on a regional level to begin with economically. I think Eduardo's right. You're not going to get any foreign investment from the north in Bolivia.
And that's the first thing the U.S. ambassador in Bolivia, David Greenlee, told the new president. He said there cannot be much interest in investing in Bolivia right now. Edward Gamarra, the way Georgianne Potter paints it, it's like Latin America is on some kind of collision course with American dreams, at least, and maybe business dreams in Latin America of where things are headed.
Well, look, you know, these are topics that stir a great deal of passion, and I'm the only Bolivian who has been speaking this evening, and perhaps it would be interesting to get other voices as well from Bolivians that are looking at this from different perspectives, because although Georgianne is right that Evo Morales leads one of the main political forces in Bolivia, he also doesn't speak for a majority of Bolivians, and Bolivians come from a wide variety of perspectives. And but having said that, let me just say that I always hear this argument about alternatives to the FTAA and alternatives to globalization and so on. But even Jeffrey Sachs, who, by the way, is the author of Bolivia's Structural Adjustment Program in 1985, and also somebody whom I have read and respect very much, in their particular recommendations, they're not really talking about modifying fundamentally the premises of globalization or even the pattern of economic development in Latin America. We still know, basically, you know, from an economics point of view, that countries need investment. And in the end, what it boils down to is the creation of jobs. And, you know, what you have in Bolivia is an economy where 72% of the population is in the informal sector. 72% of the economically active population is not tied formally into the economy. In that kind of a context, then, if you have any kind of model of growth, whether it's a socialist model, whether it's some kind of a Mercosur, a common market of the South approach, or what have you, unless you can create jobs for the vast majority of Bolivians, and the only way I know how to do that, and most economists know how to do that, is by either seeking foreign private investment, private investment domestically, or making the state perform that particular role. And we failed dramatically at doing that over the last 15 to 20 years.
It just hasn't happened. And a lot of people are walking maybe in the other direction right now. Our time is so short, I have one more question for you. Where does coca fall in all this? If the United States insists that coca be eradicated and the peasants insist that they've got to grow it, how does a politician stand between those two forces?
Well, I'm afraid that and we've had this. This is perhaps one of the areas where Georgianne and I sort of agree.
You're afraid.
The U.S. has had a very, very inflexible attitude on coca, and in large measure because of the inflexibility on particularly on the policy of eradication. Made it virtually impossible for the previous government to negotiate with people like Evo Morales, and I'm afraid that as a result now what the U.S. has essentially done, it has also given this government a very short life expectancy by insisting on harsh eradication, and I'm afraid that perhaps this is not the moment in which the U.S. ought to be insisting on a policy that has largely failed.
But no pullback so far. Wow, what a picture. I have a feeling we're going to be hearing a lot more from Bolivia. I'm very grateful to both of you for being with us tonight. Georgianne Potter in Washington, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Georgianne Potter, Senior Fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and Eduardo Gamarra in Miami. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Eduardo Gamarra, Director of the Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, wrestling with the meaning of patriotism in America today. This is On Point. With a presidential election year right around the corner, patriotism has once again become an important political buzzword. President Bush frequently appeals to Americans' sense of patriotism when trying to drum up support for the war on terror. Wesley Clark is basing his campaign on a concept his aides call New American Patriotism. Yesterday at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, a prestigious panel discussed the meaning of patriotism in America today. In this excerpt, Pulitzer Prize winners Louis Menand and Roger Wilkins share their thoughts on the meaning of patriotism. The excerpt begins with Menand relating patriotism to baseball.
You talk to New Yorkers about the Yankees, and they act as though they had something to do personally with the Yankee success. And what you want to say to them is, you just happen to be born in New York. That's all you have to do with the Yankees. It's owned by a rich guy, goes out and buys the best players, brings them to New York. They become New Yorkers, please, really. They have nothing to do with New York. And then you feel loyal to the Yankees. Okay. So what I want to suggest is this. Patriotism depends a little bit on a fiction. And the fiction is that we've chosen to be Americans. Now, some of us in this room and some of us on the panel have chosen to be Americans when they had other choices. But most of us just happened to be born here. So I want to suggest that patriotism or love of country, a healthy way to think of it is to think this. When you're born, you're handed certain things. You're handed your parents. You're handed the color of your skin. You're handed your gender. And you're handed the place you were born, New York City or the United States of America. Those are things that you can do something with. You can do something with those things. And virtue and character comes from choosing to do something with them rather than simply taking credit for something that you had nothing to do with. That's patriotism.
Roger.
Well, I hate to disagree with a professor of English. Let's talk about choice for a minute. I was handed the New York Yankees when I was 9 years old, and I lived across the river from Yankee Stadium. And I was a Yankee fan for 41 years until I could no longer stand Steinbrenner. So I resigned as a Yankee fan in an op-ed piece in the New York Times. And I declared myself to be a fan of the well-managed, well-owned Baltimore Orioles. The hardest thing I ever did was to wean myself off the Yankees. But I exercised choice, which is essence of democracy, right? And I was exercising free will. The Baltimore Orioles are now owned by a worse owner than Steinbrenner. He's destroying the team. So democracy is getting up off the ground after you've made some bad choices and believing that what you do can make the place where you live and the people around you, the place a little better, the people a little better nurtured, and to keep on going despite getting knocked down, sometimes by your own choices, sometimes by fate, sometimes by politics, but always exercising the choice to make things better.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writers Roger Wilkins and Louis Menand discussing patriotism at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook and John Perotti. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.